you know, this place has been protected so long that people just thought it would never open.
The Trump administration begins the process to open drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, military personnel provide medical services in Northwest Alaska communities.
The benefit for the armed forces is readiness training. Benefit for the region is really a blitz of services.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Today, the Trump administration took the first official step toward allowing oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Department of Interior released a notice saying it will hold no fewer than two oil lease sales in a 1.6 million acre portion of the refuge, known as the 1002 area or the coastal plain. It adds those lease sales must be held by December 2024. The announcement kicks off the first public comment period on drilling in the refuge. Interior said it will hold public meetings in Anchorage, Arctic Village, Fairbanks, Koktovik, and Utqiagvik. It did not announce any meeting locations outside Alaska. Kara Moriarty, president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, thinks that's a good idea.
I'm encouraged that the Department of Interior is not having a scoping meeting in D.C., and they're not having a scoping meeting in California or Washington or other areas of the country, that their sole mission in life is to keep our resources locked in the ground.
Moriarty says that's because a lot of the opposition to drilling in ANWR comes from the lower 48, while many Alaskans support it. But Bernadette Dementev, executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee, thinks the number of Alaskans who don't want oil development in the refuge is growing.
You know, this place has been protected so long that people just thought it would never open. But now that it is, I have faith that many Alaska Natives are going to stand up against it.
The public now has until June 19th to submit comments to the Bureau of Land Management. Interior will announce the times and locations of the public meetings in late May. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers held a public scoping meeting in Dillingham Tuesday night to get public input on the Pebble Mine plan. It was the second of three Pebble Mine scoping meetings this month without a live microphone for people to deliver their comments before the gathered audience. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
More than 80 people filtered through the Dillingham Middle School gym Tuesday night to weigh in on the possible detriments or benefits of the proposed Pebble Mine plan. They pointed out resources of concern and suggested alternatives to components of the plan. The main event at Tuesday's meeting was two stations in the back of the room. At a bank of computers, people could submit their comments online. At another table sat a court reporter. People took turns speaking to her, and she recorded their comments. People could also give written comments to those running the meeting. At the other six meetings in Bristol Bay, the Army Corps provided a live microphone for people to deliver their comments publicly to the gathered audience. It did not provide that opportunity in Dillingham, Homer, or Anchorage. Many in Dillingham were frustrated not to have the same opportunity for public testimony as the meetings in Bristol Bay's villages. Chogyong Tribal Council was among those who criticized the Army Corps for not providing a live microphone. Second Chief Gayla Hossett said that the meeting's format was inconsistent with Alaska Native people's tradition of oral communication. Kimberly Williams is a member chief of Chogyong Tribe.
I'm really upset with the Army Corps of Engineers for what is happening in Dillingham. They are treating us very differently than the other communities. I've worked on this project for like 14 years, and disseminating information is really important. I'm not telling people how to think. I'm asking people what their opinions are related to this project. And we want people in Dillingham and our tribal members to come out and testify and let them know what their concerns are.
The Army Corps said that it anticipated a high turnout for the meeting and that public comment could have taken too long. It also cited a concern that testimony in a hub community could be front-loaded with perspectives overwhelmingly for or against the proposed mine. Sheila Newman, Regulatory Division Deputy Chief with the Army Corps Alaska District, said that Dillingham and other larger venues could have the chance to offer public testimony after the Army Corps releases a draft of the environmental impact statement.
Public scoping meetings are something we do to supplement scoping to make it easy for the public to provide input. Public hearings are a different endeavor that come later in the process, and that is truly a listening session where we as a federal agency would be walking into the room and just listening to public viewpoints on a project. There is an appropriate time for that in the Department of the Army permit application review process. And to correlate it with this EIS process, it would be at the draft EIS stage.
The Corps of Engineers anticipates releasing a draft of the EIS in January of 2019. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Scheduled scoping meetings on the project wrap up this week, with the final meeting in Anchorage tonight. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers will take public comment on the Pebble Mine plan until June 29th. People in 12 Northwest Arctic communities can get free health care services this week, thanks to the U.S. Armed Forces Operation Arctic Care, which happens every 3 years. Paul Hansen is the administrator of the Manilik Association, the healthcare system for the Northwest Arctic Borough. He says it's a win-win scenario.
The benefit for the armed forces is readiness training. Benefit for the region is really a blitz of services.
The services include a full range of regular medical care, plus dental, eye, and veterinary care. They're all available at Manilik's 11 clinics throughout the region and at the Manilik Health Center in Kotzebue. Hansen says Arctic Care provides procedures like colonoscopies that aren't normally available, but it also helps with more routine things.
Every year, we have to do sports physicals for all the kids in school, and we have a constant need in early August, we're trying to catch all the cross-country kids, and then comes wrestling season, then comes basketball season, and Native Youth Olympics. So they help us take care of that.
Hansen says village operations for the U.S. Armed Forces are usually a smooth process.
I know that the military gets a lot of respect around here, and people really appreciate the work they do. And so, Arctic Care is really well received.
The approximately 100 reservists are from all four branches of the U.S. Armed Forces, as well as from Canadian Air Force and Army. That's according to Sergeant Joseph Sims, Public Affairs Officer for the Air Force Reserve. He says Arctic Care helps reservists who have regular day jobs get ready for crisis response scenarios like hurricanes.
They're able to take their experience both militarily and in the civilian roles and help the people of Northwest Alaska.
And Sim says working with other branches of the armed forces is great training for deployment.
It's a joint environment because it's not just Air Force and Army going out by themselves. We're working together, and that's only going to benefit us in a deployed environment.
Arctic Care continues through this Saturday. Borough residents can contact their local clinic to sign up for an appointment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a local competition is fostering potential renewable energy solutions.
There's a nugget of gold in every idea, but you have to figure out what that is and what you're solving.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
The state Senate has joined the House in passing a resolution calling on the federal government to respect Alaska's legalization of marijuana. The resolution, sponsored by Fairbanks Representative David Guttenberg, also asks the federal government to reconsider its listing of marijuana as a Schedule I drug, a move Senator Berta Gardner told fellow senators would fix several issues in Alaska.
Solves the banking problems, solves the federal enforcement issues and all of the concerns of people who are involved either in the industry or recreational use of marijuana in our state.
The resolution passed both the House and Senate with unanimous support. Alaska voters approved recreational use of marijuana by those 21 and older in 2014, but it has taken time for businesses in some rural communities like Haines to come online. Glacier Bay Farms is set to be among the first legal marijuana businesses there. The commercial recreational marijuana grow operation has brought together an unlikely team of entrepreneurs, a 78-year-old grandmother, and a handful of millennials who are hoping to have their first harvest by the end of the year. Dacia Eaton with KHNS and Haines has more.
For more than 50 years, Carol Waldo's family has operated a business in Haines.
We've done anything to make a living that was legal, I guess you could say.
Logging, trucking, construction, concrete, equipment rental, and snow plowing, among other things.
If you live in Alaska, especially in a community like this where we're kind of isolated, you have to be able to do a lot of different things in order to survive.
And now she's becoming a pioneer in a new kind of business, the newly legal commercial recreational marijuana industry. It's under construction now, and if all goes as planned, Glacier Bay Farms will be up and running by the end of the year. It's one of several marijuana cultivation and retail businesses in Haines going through the lengthy state licensing process. With silver hair cropped just above her shoulders and sparkling blue eyes, the 5'1" grandmother says she never imagined she'd be growing and selling marijuana.
I've never smoked marijuana, and I've never eaten marijuana. I mean, it's not anything that I've tried yet. That doesn't mean I won't try it at some point. I might. I'm 78 years old. I guess I can kind of do what I want.
Waldo explains she does use oil derived from cannabis, CBD oil, orally for her type 2 diabetes and topically to treat arthritis. CBD is not psychoactive. She talks business around her kitchen table over a batch of freshly baked chocolate chip cookies.
I just baked them a couple hours ago.
I will have one before I go.
Okay.
Thank you.
Waldo arrived in Alaska from the Midwest via the Alcan Highway as a young child in 1948. Waldo still manages the family business, Waldo Enterprises, which was established in 1964. She says she believes legal marijuana businesses can bring economic development to the town, which mostly relies on fishing and tourism.
Haines needs some economy. They need some tax money. They need jobs. And one of the things that is important to me is to see young people move here with their families, send their kids to school, buy their groceries at the stores here in town.
She already employs about 5 young people who live here and hopes to employ many more as her business develops. One of them is 28-year-old Gordon Julian.
We have 2 buildings. They're going to be identical. Each building is going to have 48 lights.
Julian stands in a clearing next to the Waldo family salvage yard at the foot of Mount Rapinski, where 2 long rectangular windowless buildings are under construction. Julian, who says he worked in the legal medical marijuana industry in Michigan, is putting the grow operation together. He steps inside one building and describes what it will be like when the electricity's hooked up.
At any given time, we could have, between the 2 buildings, close to 800 plants going at one time.
Betsy Shiner, also 28 and from Michigan, is part of the team too. She actually trained to be a preschool teacher.
I trained at Michigan State University, but the teaching in our country does not pay very well right now. So I have a lot of student loans, hoping to get some money to pay back those.
She says she's excited to be involved in a growing industry that pays well.
This is like an industry where there's promise for a future.
Waldo says she's very interested in eventually expanding her business to focus on medical marijuana products. She also has an interest in developing marijuana tourism and possibly a dispensary in Haines. In a small town, Waldo says there are always skeptics, critics, and detractors. But she wants people here to know that she's going into the pot business because she cares about the future of Haines.
We're not fly by night. We aren't here to make money and leave. We're here to make a living, hire people, and better our community.
Bettering the community and creating a business that she plans to pass on to her son and grandchildren here. But for now, the septuagenarian hopes that she and her team of millennials will be wholesaling bud to dispensaries in Juneau by the end of 2018. In Haines, I'm Dacia Eaton.
Wrangell's first marijuana dispensary opened this month. Happy Cannabis owner Kelsey Martinson says he's been working toward opening day for about 2 years.
The state has pretty firm guidelines of what to do. Our biggest problem was getting the mechanical work done in a timely manner, since this is kind of a hard to get to. Hard to get to a place there. So.
The city of Wrangell approved his license last spring. Happy Cannabis has 7 strains of marijuana available at its store behind the now-defunct Diamond C Cafe, a downtown restaurant Martinson owned. The marijuana comes from Common Collective, a grower in Houston, Alaska. Martinson does not sell edibles or paraphernalia right now. He's cultivating cannabis that he would ship off the island and possibly sell at his store. Plenty of Southeast towns already have dispensaries. Those include Juneau, Skagway, Petersburg, Sitka, and Ketchikan. Recent exploration around the Pogo mine near Delta Junction has shown promising evidence of more rich deposits of gold nearby. A Pogo geologist told a group of miners and industry officials earlier this month that more exploration will be needed before the company officials can decide whether to expand the operation and develop the resources. But as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the officials are excited about the potential.
Pogo Exploration Superintendent Gabe Graff's PowerPoint was a largely technical talk, like most given during last week's Alaska Miners Association biennial conference. But in the course of the presentation, he offered a comment or two about some drilling done last year in the Good Pasture prospect that even a layman could understand.
So we just turned the rig, drilled a shallower hole coming across. In this hole, we hit 17.5 feet of 1.739 ounce per ton. Very good. Very excited about that.
That means the sample taken from that drill hole suggests more than 1.7 ounces of gold could be refined from a ton of ore extracted from that area. That's a very rich concentration that, if proven with subsequent exploration, would be well above the amount needed to make a very good profit for mine owner Sumitomo Metal Mining Pogo.
We're really excited about the Good Pasture right now.
In an interview after his talk, Graff was cautiously optimistic about the results of last year's drilling around the Good Pasture prospect, but he reiterated the need for more drilling around the area before company officials would even consider developing the resource.
We don't have a lot of information yet. We only have a few drill holes in these areas, but based on the few drill holes we do have, very encouraging results.
Pogo General Manager Chris Kennedy also is upbeat, cautiously so, about both the Good Pasture prospect and another called the Fun Zone that's located nearer to the mine.
The early information that we're getting back from exploration between last year and, of course, some information this year shows that there's a lot of potential north of the property. The Fun Zone shows a lot of potential. West Good Pasture shows a huge amount of potential.
The Good Pasture prospect is located west of the river of the same name, about 2 miles west of the property around the mill, all of which is located about 35 miles northeast of Delta. Kennedy says Sumitomo Pogo plans to spend $21 million on exploration this year to learn more about those and other prospects closer to the mine. He says developing more of the area's gold potential could mean the mine will continue operating and providing jobs.
It's exciting for us, because the potential means we continue to expand our mine life out there, and we continue to keep 320 employees. We continue to keep 100-plus contractors employed, and we continue to be able to contribute to the community like we have been doing in the past 10, 12 years.
Kennedy was referring to the annual donation Pogo Sumitomo gives to the city of Delta and other area causes. The company gave Delta $150,000 last year and another $150,000 to an organization that provides services to the greater Deltana area. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Curious about your alcohol habits or those of someone you care about? Find a free and confidential alcohol screening at recoveralaska.org or call 211 today. This Alcohol Awareness Month, Recover Alaska reminds us that together we are stronger than alcohol addiction. Recover Alaska is a trusted source for alcohol research and resources, including an index of local available treatment options. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
Failing fast sounds like a bad thing. But when it comes to fostering the state's growing renewable energy sector, a group out of the University of Alaska thinks failure can be useful. So they've designed a unique competition for Alaskans to come up with renewable energy business ideas that probably won't work, at least not at first. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk explains.
At a sports bar in downtown Anchorage, Huey Winston and Susanna Caldwell are hammering out the final details on a renewable energy website they're creating.
Even like a sun, you know what I mean? Like a solar energy and a SurgeK, whatever.
I think SurgeK, you could have like a little lightning bolt or whatever, you know, like an electrical current or something.
They're designing a website for Volt 49, a competition organized by the University of Alaska's Center for Economic Development. They're one of four teams from across the state who are given a unique challenge related to renewable energy in Alaska, and they have 5 weeks to solve it. One team, for example, has been working on how to power a server farm. Winston and Caldwell's team was tasked with powering an off-grid cabin with renewables. Winston says their concept has changed a lot over the past few weeks. His first idea was a backpack filled with equipment.
Then it evolved into like this cube, which was made of solar panels that kind of fold out.
But then, 3 weeks into the competition, the organizers hooked the team up with a solar energy expert.
To me, what I heard them say was like, yo, that's never going to work. It's way too heavy. Because you have a battery pack.
The expert also pointed out another tiny issue with the whole cube idea.
He was saying every solar panel is rectangular, so there's no way to make a cube with solar panels.
Finding out their cube was a flop was a big setback. But organizer Julia Casey with the Center for Economic Development says that's exactly what the Volt 49 competition is designed to do.
So most ideas are garbage, and I say that in a loving way.
Casey says by forcing teams to develop a renewable energy tool in 5 short weeks, they fail fast. It's based off what's called a design sprint, an exercise born in Silicon Valley. Google uses it to jumpstart new business ideas. Casey says the tight time frame is key.
A lot of times people have a great idea, build it, and 10 years later they realize this doesn't work.
But she says putting garbage ideas out there isn't a bad thing, especially if you can do it quickly.
Usually there's still a nugget of gold. Like there's a nugget of gold in every idea, but you have to figure out what that is and what you're solving.
Casey admits the ideas the Volt 49 teams are coming up with now probably aren't multi-million dollar businesses, and she's okay with that. She says the goal is to unearth those nuggets of gold a little faster, and meanwhile, teach the teams about all the things Alaska's renewable energy sector has going for it.
In renewable energy, we have a lot of expertise in very specific challenges that happen in remote rural places, happen where energy is very difficult to create. So that is really, really cool and can be translated throughout the world and other places that have similar challenges.
There are now over 100 Alaska businesses working in renewable energy, according to a new report from UAA. And most of those firms aren't focused on products. With their experience working in Alaska's remote or extreme conditions, their biggest selling point is expertise. Back at the Volt 49 team meeting, Caldwell explains that's kind of the idea behind the website they developed. It's called SurgeK, and it's designed as a one-stop shop for off-grid cabin owners wanting power from renewables.
There's a lot of renewable energy information out there and a lot of products and stuff like that. But where, if you're an Alaskan, where could you go to find all of that?
Caldwell and her teammates don't think this website is going to make them a lot of money. None of them are quitting their day jobs after the competition ends. But Caldwell says she's learned a lot.
If I ever decided to become an entrepreneur, business idea or whatever, it really has shifted my perspective on how you do that.
And that's exactly what Volt 49's organizers are after. Giving Alaskans new skills, and if they're lucky, an early garbage idea that could someday lead to the state's next big renewable energy startup. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Sea Alaska Corporation distributed more than $23 million to its shareholders on Friday. It's twice last spring's amount, in part because the Southeast Regional Native Corporation's own businesses are making more money. But the largest part of many shareholders' checks comes from other regional Native Corporation earnings. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld explains how that works.
The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act created 12 regional corporations. Some ended up with large stands of trees, rare mineral deposits, or other valuable natural resources. Others did not. So the act and a later legal agreement required those with more to share their wealth with those with less. See, Alaska used to be one of the ones with more. It made a lot of money off its timberlands and shared 70% with other regional corporations. But in more recent years, it's been getting considerable revenue from two of its northern cousins. One is Arctic Slope, which is in the oil business.
That's been down from historic levels and is still down from historic levels.
Anthony Malott is Sea Alaska's president and CEO. He says the other owns the subsurface rights to a profitable mine.
This last year, zinc prices have been headed upward, and there is more income from the Red Dog mine that Nana is the landowner of.
Dividend totals differ. This year, they range from $13.50 to less than 10% of that amount per share. That's because the corporation's more than 22,000 shareholders are divided into classes. For those getting the most, more than 80% comes from the shared revenue pool. A little more than 10% comes from the corporation's own businesses. Malott says they're doing well.
The land management natural resource business is one of the leaders. We're actively investing in the seafood side, meaning expectation that seafood will quickly be the greatest source of income for Sea Alaska.
The corporation continues to earn money through investments and government contracting.
They were all profitable in 2017, just like they were all profitable in 2016, and they're all growing.
If this is the trend line for Sea Alaska, that's great news.
Nicole Hollingstad is a former vice president and corporate secretary for Sea Alaska. She's also run for its board of directors as an independent and sometimes critical candidate.
Shareholders want to support the corporation, and they're excited that the corporation seems to be on a trend of profitability.
It's hard to tell how well Sea Alaska's different subsidiaries are doing. That's because the corporation reports financial results by sector, not for each separate company. Hollingstad says that's understandable because corporations don't want competitors to know too much about their businesses. But she thinks Sea Alaska could be more transparent in its dividends breakdown for shareholders.
It would be great if there was a number that showed the earnings from our subsidiary holdings as opposed to the investment holdings. And that way shareholders really can begin to track how well our subsidiary operations are doing.
About 5 years ago, Sea Alaska's revenues dropped significantly due to more than $30 million in losses from its construction subsidiary and some other operations. The losses were spread out over several years, but Malott says they're no longer part of the dividend equation. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Gabe Colombo in Nome, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Dacia Eaton in Haines, June Leffler in Wrangell, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Ridley is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.